Welcome to the Borders and Globalization podcast. Welcome to our listeners. I'm speaking from the traditional territory of the Lekwungen peoples in the Salish Sea region. Today, we are pleased to welcome Mikael Carpenter, who is political scientist at the University of Victoria, Canada. His research interests include borders, migration, democracy, civil resistance, and people power, especially in the context of the Middle East and Palestine in particular. He wrote a book. The title is Palestinian Popular Struggle, Unarmed and Participatory in 20, and he was published this book in 2019. Mikael edited several other books about borders as the managing editor of Borders and Globalization Review. So our interview today will focus on popular protest, the Middle East, and borders. Welcome, Mikael Carpenter.
Hi, Ben. Thank you. It's great to be with you.
To begin our interview, Mikael, can you briefly share with us some words about your research interests? Why Middle East region, and why the topic borders and popular protest?
Yeah, thank you. First, I do want to specify that as a third generation settler here on the unceded territories of the Lekwungen and the Wasanich and Esquimalt peoples, I'm trying to better understand and support indigenous resurgence movements and resilience, a kind of popular struggle in the form of, I think of it as a kind of popular struggle like social movements in the form of Idle No More, or localized struggles like the Wet'suwet'en struggle and the struggle at Fairy Creek, involving the water protectors and the land defenders and much more. But not only such sort of acute struggles like these, but also everyday acts that raise awareness and open space for indigenous knowledges and traditions to grow, and specifically to counter and to challenge conventional notions of statehood and sovereignty and rights and responsibilities. And my own research background focuses on the theory or the conceptualizations and the practices of popular struggle, and mostly in the context, and especially, as you mentioned, the Middle East. In terms of the theory, it's really grounded in, I think, the idea that popular struggle or popular politics or popular protest, it offers a useful category for thinking about some of the shared traits or underlying commonalities behind maybe it's better known or more studied under the rubric of social movements, contentious politics, protest movements, civil disobedience, civil resistance, this sort of thing, everyday resistances, direct action. It's community-based, it's participatory. And I think the term popular, which is not to be confused with populist, right? I think it helps to recognize this shared quality of a certain type of politics. It's not bound or contained in established or conventional institutions. It's more transgressive and it's more bottom up than top down. It's popular. And I think of that as meaning of the people, of the populace. And this is to distinguish it from formal party politics and legal institutions, and also from the category of nationalism, right? There can be some interplay and overlap between popular politics and politics as usual, but the center of gravity of popular politics is not inside the state itself. And I also like the concept of popular because it evades or sidesteps some of the semantic and ethical debates around uses of terms like nonviolent and civil and even nationalist. Popular politics does not rest on first asserting a commitment to nonviolence. It tends to be mostly nonviolent, but popular politics is not bound to the sort of the complex ethical vision of, say, Gandhi or Martin Luther King, just as it's not necessarily tied to nationalism. It can be nonviolent and civil, but it can also be unruly, and sometimes it can even include some forms of violence in struggle.
Yeah.
It can be, and just to build on that, it can be small and local, or it can be at the national scale with nationalist overtones. But the key features of popular politics is that it's of the people, not of the state. And then within that category of popular politics, there are all sorts of debates and theories and approaches that we could talk about. But my regional focus has been, as you said, the Middle East, and especially Israel-Palestine. And my book, and it looks in particular at a specific grassroots movement in the occupied West Bank, which is today probably actually, it's been quite repressed, this movement. And my book contextualizes this movement within the broader context of Palestinian struggle and in the tradition of the first intifada, or the first mass uprising that happened in the late 1980s. And I've done some research there. I spent 6 months in the occupied West Bank, and my book came out of that experience. But I'm also interested in the Middle East more broadly. I teach and I do research in these areas, and also in the field of international relations and political theory, very much steeped in the Western tradition, but interested in its critiques and its challengers. And so borders are a very natural part of international relations and Middle East politics, and therefore borders and globalization is a great fit for me. And I'm grateful to be part of that program. My research here is going into the notion of cross-border protest, specifically how to think about and how to recognize forms of migration or irregular migration as a kind of popular struggle, as a kind of transnational civil disobedience or a new frontier in human rights. And I have some work on that that's coming out soon.
Great. Thank you, Michael, for this great introduction about your research interests. Now, let's talk about specifically about the region of your research. And we know that during the existence of the Ottoman Empire, one could visit the empire without crossing any international borders. There were many administrative divisions, but they were united under the authority of the same sovereign power. This vast empire with a great cultural diversity disappeared after the First World War. And we have seen the appearance of a new model built on the nation state with spatial divisions established by great powers without the consent of the local populations. In this complex political landscape, one can observe nations in search of a state and states in search of a nation. But before speaking about borders within the Middle East, let's speak about the boundaries of the expression Middle East per se. What does the expression Middle East mean?
That's a really complex question. It's a great question, and we could talk for quite a while about it. But I think it's good to start by pointing out, on the one hand, that it's not a very good term, the Middle East. It's very ambiguous. It's very Eurocentric, because it's based on the sort of geographic perspective of the region that we call the Middle East from Europe. So it's the Middle East as opposed to the Far East. But it's a generalization that really comes out of a Eurocentric world and a history of colonialism. And so for that reason alone, it should be suspect. But it's also a lot like the term the West, or the global north, or the global south. I think it's important to emphasize that these are more like political concepts than geographic, you know, specifiers. Because the Middle East is, what exactly does that mean? It's really relative to Europe. It doesn't specify any continents or specific areas. But nonetheless, we all sort of agree what it sort of generally refers to, just like the West, just like the global North, just like the global South. There are always exceptions or contradictions in the term. For example, if you think about the West, you know, there are parts of North Africa that are further west than Paris. Mm-hmm. And from where we are in North America on the West Coast, China is to our west and we are to their east. So these terms don't really have a lot of geographic validity, but they're useful as political concepts to more or less, in large part, but not entirely, mapping onto a geographic model, but for the most part meant to signify regions that are held together, I think, through historical, cultural, and political relationships that overlap. So what is the Middle East? Some people like to restrict the notion of the Middle East to just that eastern part of the Mediterranean, say, sometimes called the Levant, encompassing Syria and Palestine and Jordan and extending up to the Persian Gulf and including Iran. But others would say, well, clearly parts of North Africa are also a part of the Middle East, because you can't talk about the Middle East without including Egypt or Libya. To say that Egypt or Libya are not included in the Middle East, I think is a little bit absurd. Yet we do this when we specify the notion of the Middle East and North Africa. It's very trendy in social science right now to always say the MENA region or the Middle East and North Africa region, as if they're two separate regions. But I think that's a little bit problematic, because North Africa is a geographic term applying to a continent. The Middle East, as I've said, is more of a political concept to designate a region and a culture and an intermingling of cultures and histories. So I personally think Middle East and North Africa is a bit of a contradiction of terms. And when we say the Middle East, North Africa is implied, right? Mm-hmm. So what does that actually mean, though? Okay, so if the Middle East is this loose signifier, and in some ways, the looseness of it, the ambiguity of it, is another strength, because we don't have to say the Islamic world or the Arabic world or the Turkish and Arabic and Persian worlds. But this is what we're really referring to. On the whole, when we say Middle East, we're conjuring up a world with multiple faiths and multiple peoples, though predominantly three peoples and one faith. So let's break that down. The three peoples are the three civilizations are the Turkish, the Arabic, and the Persian. And I think that's the Middle East, because you can't think of the Middle East without the Arab world. You can't think of the Middle East without Iran, which is not Arabic, it's a Persian country. And you can't think of the Middle East without Turkey, for exactly the reasons you outlined in the question. It has this history of being a colonial imperial power in the region that really united a lot of this part of the world in sort of an intermingling of shared cultures and traditions and politics. Mm-hmm. So I think Middle East is a useful term in that it allows us to avoid specifying a particular people or religion to that, and it allows for the diversity within it. Now, it's not just the Arabs and the Turks and the Persians. Of course, there are many minorities, just like it's not just Muslim, because there are many different faiths, but mm-hmm. these are predominantly the trends of the population and the demographics there.
Great. Thank you for these very important clarifications, Michael, about this ambiguous notion. My next question is about the topic of borders and disputes in the Middle East in general and within the context of Israel and Palestine in particular. The recent years has been rich in political and territorial news with the conflict in Syria, the Islamic State, etc. According to you, Michael, what are the main and current challenges related to borders in this Middle East? And could you remind us of the some key elements of the conflict between Israel and Palestine?
Yes, a great question. So, of course, the Middle East has its share of border challenges and border disputes. One thinks about the country of Morocco has been occupying Western Sahara, you know, this border dispute between these two countries for many decades. There have also been in the news in recent years tensions between Egypt and Sudan over their border. And probably the border issue, I think, that would come to mind for most people in terms of recent years developments would be the ISIS, the rise of ISIS, the Islamic State, which literally bulldozed the parts of the border between Syria and Iraq, right? It carved out, territorially carved out this section for its state or its caliphate that spanned what was once portions of Syria and Iraq. So the border very much came into question during the rise of ISIS and the war against ISIS. But for the most part, I think that has been resolved. ISIS is no longer controlling significant amounts of territory, and the old borders between Iraq and Syria have reemerged, I think, as stable as ever. But probably the case that comes to mind that is most significant in terms of the challenges around borders and border disputes in the Middle East is the case of Israel-Palestine. Mm-hmm. And on the one hand, this looks like a classical case of a border dispute, right? Where's the border between Israel and Palestine? Mm-hmm. If we could only figure that out, then we could maybe establish peace between two states. Well, the international community and international law have mostly resolved that question. More or less, the outlines of a two-state solution between Israel and Palestine have been clear since the 1960s. And it basically looks like creating a Palestinian state on the very lands that are currently militarily occupied by Israel since 1967. And that's the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem. According to international law and the international community, that right there is the outlines for peace. Israel gives up the occupied territories. Palestine creates a state on those territories, and the border becomes what is sometimes called the Green Line, mm-hmm. or the 1967 line, which previously had marked the extent of Israel's territorial control, but after 1967 divided Israel from its occupied territories because it expanded at that time, and the territories that it occupied, the Palestinian territories that it occupied, came to be seen in the international community as the potential ground for the Palestinian state. So all we need to do is end that occupation that has been going on for, 55 years, and that's where you construct a Palestinian state. So from the international community's perspective, there's a border problem here, but the border, with some uncertainties and some fine-tuning, the parameters of a border between the two states is pretty clear. But there are some big problems with this approach. This is a very border-centric approach, and I think it reveals some of the limits of international thinking and the limits of international territorial boundaries, because it's very difficult to actually imagine that this line could become a border between these two states. There's a number of problems with it. Probably the biggest problem is the recognized problem of the Israeli settlements on those Palestinian territories.
Yeah.
You have in the West Bank, the occupied Palestinian territory of the West Bank, you have approximately a fifth of the population is made up of Israeli settlers. And these Israeli settlers have been exported from Israel proper across the 1967 Green Line into the occupied territory as Israeli citizens with full Israeli rights and, you know, passports, but located in these settlements within the occupied territory. And it's on that basis that the international community recognizes the Israeli settlements in the West Bank as illegal. In fact, violations of the Geneva Conventions, which state that an occupying power can't transfer its own population into territory it's taken by force. Exactly. So the settlements are illegal by international law, but also a major obstacle to this notion of a two-state solution. If that becomes Palestine, what happens to the Israeli settlements? Does this lead to a massive transfer of Israeli settlers out of the West Bank? Would they be mandated to leave? Would they still be Israeli citizens if they're inside a Palestinian state? So that right there is a major conundrum. And many Israeli analysts have said if there was any attempt to uproot even a large portion of the settlers, there would be a Jewish civil war.
Okay.
So that's a major problem in it. But the reverse is also true on the other side of the line, because there are a lot of Palestinians inside of Israel. About a fifth of the population is Palestinian, non-Jewish Palestinians in the state of Israel. And would they become Palestinian citizens of the state on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, or would they? So there's this problem of the blended population on either side. But more than that, the country itself is really geographically and historically, it's one country. You can see, if you look at a map and the geography, Jerusalem is really the hub of this part of the world. And from there, the roads and the other parts of the country kind of unfurl like spokes of a wheel. So to imagine that you could divide the country and one side or the other would have Jerusalem is a bit unrealistic. And this is why they refer, many people use the expression from the river to the sea, because Palestine is a natural country between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. And to try to separate it, it hasn't worked so far. And maybe the other thing about it too, maybe much more interesting and promising approaches recognize this, and then it can become a sort of a laboratory for thinking about the finer points of sovereignty, territory, and borders. For example, what about a one-state solution? And this could be like a federal state. It could be a binational state. It could be geographically overlapping, but distinct sovereignties. So political thinking should not be trapped in this binary territorial two-state model.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's not fantastic to speculate about alternative forms of governance in this context. We know from Canada's experience, we know from the experience of the EU, from other cases, that a strictly territorialist approach is not the only option on the table. There are creative configurations of nationalism, sovereignty, and territory. But it's always important to say that this is an academic discussion, right? Mm-hmm. Ultimately, it's up to the people who live there, all the people who live there, not just the Jewish citizenry, but the stateless, dispossessed Palestinian people as well need to have a say in what form their government takes. And this is where popular struggle becomes a useful lens of analysis for me. Now, interestingly, so beyond those cases that I've mentioned, Morocco and Egypt, Sudan, and ISIS and Israel, Palestine, it seems like border disputes are a massive part of the whole region. But really, that's not the case. For the most part, borders have been pretty stable across the region, even quite naturalized in most countries. Remember, this is more than two dozen countries, and for the most part, the borders have been stable for 100 years. Okay. A good example of this is the Arab Spring. In 2011, we had these mass protests erupt across the Arab world. You had some governments fall, you had some civil wars erupt, but in no case were borders challenged between these. We often think of them as colonial historical constructs, yet they have tended to not be challenged in most of the countries of the region and their own politics. So I think it's fascinating and important to remember that the borders, though ultimately artificial constructs, have in many ways become entrenched and seem to be quite durable.
Great. Thank you, Michael, for sharing this very complete and interesting history of this complex region. On the specific case of relations between Israel and Palestine, can you remind us of the key elements of this conflict, please?
Yes. You know, I often forget that, you know, Israel-Palestine doesn't mean a lot to a lot of people. It's even though it's one of the most talked about and news covered conflicts in the world today, I think it's also very misunderstood. So it's helpful to think about it in terms of a number of myths. And one of the myths about the Israel-Palestine conflict is that it's not, contrary to the myth, it's not centuries old. It's actually quite a young conflict. It really doesn't predate the year 1948. You'll often hear people casually say, oh, they've been fighting over there for thousands of years. Well, it's simply not true. Prior to British colonial occupation of the region after the First World War, there was really no such thing as even an ethnic conflict in the region between the Jews and the non-Jewish Arabs of the region. But really with the advent of the creation of the Jewish state, and this is the Zionist movement that really developed momentum in the wake of the First World War when Britain was the colonial power in the region and helped to facilitate the influx of European Jews to create a Jewish state in this country that had been long known as Palestine in the Western world. And after 1948, or sorry, after the Second World War and the Holocaust, international momentum for the creation of a Jewish state in the land, in the Holy Land, ultimately succeeded in creating the Jewish state of Israel in 1948. So it's important to remember that for years, for centuries, for millennia, there had been no Jewish state, and the Jewish persecution as minorities, vulnerable minorities in so many countries of the world, helped to create the momentum for a Jewish nationalism, that is Zionism. And this movement ultimately led to the creation of the state of Israel. On the one hand, a safe haven for Jews of the world, a place where Jewish people could have refuge and not have to fear for another Holocaust or further persecution. So this is really at the core of the creation of Israel, and I think why so many Western states have supported the country so strongly since that time. But it's come with an immense humanitarian and geopolitical cost, and that is that to create a Jewish state in that part of the world was to deny the rights of self-determination of another people, the Arabic Palestinian people, who expected to receive independence, just like all the other Arab states in the region eventually achieved independence post-colonization. Post-World War II, they became independent states, Egypt, Syria, Libya, but not Palestine. Palestine, you could think of as having been sacrificed at the altar of creating a Jewish state. So the majority of the population was displaced. The majority of the population became refugees internationally, refugees to this day, a stateless population that enjoys secondhand citizenship or even third-hand citizenship in the state of Israel, and no citizenship at all in the occupied territories, the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. So to this day, you have one side that is dispossessed, stateless, citizens of nowhere, being governed and controlled by the state of Israel, whether directly in Israel proper or in the occupied territories under martial law. Mm-hmm. And this dynamic is also important to refute another myth about this conflict. It's not a conflict between two states. It's a conflict between one predominant military regional superpower, Israel, and a stateless, dispossessed people struggling for rights of self-determination or basic civil rights. And I think that's an important lens to to remember.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yes. And I guess so the current status of it is we should think of it today as a national liberation struggle. We should think of it today about the denial of rights and how to resolve the situation of two peoples and one land. And I think that that helps to highlight some of the key elements of the conflict today.
Great, Michael. Thank you. As you have said, we know that there are many border features imposed by Israel on the occupied Palestinian territories. Although settlements are widely recognized by the international community to be a barrier to peace, they are continuing to expand, as you have elaborated on that. But concretely, what are the reactions of the Palestinians located in the Gaza Strip or in the West Bank? What are the daily living conditions in these spaces?
Great question. They don't have a lot of options. Specifically in the occupied territories, as you're asking about. And if you're looking at the entire Palestinian population in the country, that is between the river and the sea, that includes Israel and the occupied territories, more than half of the Palestinians, about three quarters of them, are stateless under occupation. And if they stand up for political rights, they will be subjected to military law. They will be subjected to travel restrictions in the form of not having their permits accepted by the military when they want to travel from one town to another, or if they want to go work in a city where they don't live. You need these passports approved by the military to travel on a regular daily basis, and it makes it very difficult. So if a Palestinian speaks out at great risk to their livelihood, to the livelihoods of their families, and it makes it very difficult for mass opposition movements to form. Now, nonetheless, Palestinians have always struggled. They've always fought back in one form or another. And probably the most common popular form of daily opposition to the occupation and the expanding settlements and the constant threat of displacement is called samud, this Arabic term samud, which can be translated as steadfastness or steadfastness on the land, a kind of resilience, or if you like, a kind of resurgence. It just means getting up every day, maintaining the institutions, the community institutions that you have, tending the fields that you have, getting married and having children, all of this in the context of occupation and the threat, the ongoing threat of displacement, is itself a kind of resistance. And Palestinians understand it under the term samud. But resistance also takes other more direct forms as well. It's mostly unarmed. The Palestinian tradition of resistance over 100 years since the start of British authorized Jewish European Jewish colonized immigration into the country has mostly been unarmed, non-militarized resistance. Nonviolent isn't maybe the best term for it, because Palestinians have a very sort of militant tradition of popular protest, and it often involves throwing stones at the occupier, throwing stones at Israeli military forces, or before Israel, throwing stones at the British colonial forces. If you've ever seen the landscape, you know there's no shortage of stones. It's this rocky, stone-covered, hilly country, basically. So protest, unarmed struggle, stone throwing has been very common, but also classic forms of civil disobedience, nonviolent direct action, everything from demonstrations to boycotts to strikes. So boycotting Israeli products, Israeli cigarettes, Israeli sodas, and trying to only buy local. Also boycotting Israeli institutions, not participating in the military governance institutions that control their lives, and strikes in the form of student strikes, but especially labor strikes. So withdrawing their cheap labor from segments of the Israeli economy, Palestinians have at times in the past been able to leverage considerable pressure to draw attention to their cause. And they have also resorted to armed struggle. And sometimes this has taken the form of sort of extreme acts of violence like suicide bombing, or from the Gaza Strip, sometimes firing these kind of homemade rockets over the Gaza border into Israel as a kind of protest of their continued entrapment within the Gaza Strip, within the blockade of the Gaza Strip. And sometimes you'll have gun attacks. So there have been periods and phases and tactics of armed struggle. But for the most part, the history of Palestinian struggle has been what I would think of as unarmed popular struggle. And I think it's worth pointing out at this point, too, the important difference between the context of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. In the West Bank is where the settlements are, where the Israeli settlements continue to expand and push more and more Palestinian communities off their lands, out of their villages, to make way for these expanding Israeli settlements. But in the Gaza Strip, which is a much much smaller pocket of land, there are no Israeli settlers there, but the Israeli military still controls that small coastal enclave. Israel controls the land borders, the land crossings, the sea, the airspace, the electromagnetic spectrum, the currency, the taxes, the birth registry. So like all of occupied Palestinian territory, the Gaza Strip should not be thought of as independent or separate from Israel or the Israeli occupation. The Gaza Strip is still occupied by Israel, even though it is governed in a local's way by the Hamas resistance movement. But I think it's important to remember that the occupation persists, even though there are no settlements there, and even though Hamas is still conducting this resistance governance of the small territory. So in the Gaza Strip, which has been sealed off in probably the most brutal blockade in contemporary times, maybe with Yemen, the blockade of Yemen by Saudi Arabia is probably the only contender for that. So the people of Gaza, you have 2 million people in a plot of land that is, very small, something like the size of Manhattan or something like that. I think smaller than that. I know it's the territorial equivalent of Regina, Saskatchewan. And that is about 2 million people. And they can't come and go. They're trapped there for generations. The Israelis don't allow development. They don't allow transport in and out. They control everything that goes in, from food to trade. So things are very different in those two contexts. And I guess to sum that up, Palestinians are fighting back despite incredible odds and adversity.
Thank you, Michael, for this very important information and clarification from the ground. A few questions ago, you spoke about the Green Line. And the evolution of this Green Line makes me suggest that a stable linear border between two states is replaced by several types of legal limits and specific devices. Notably, the system of barriers and walls. So my next question is about the walling process, the bordering process with the walls. Of course, as you have said, walls are being built all around the world, of course. But my next two questions are going to be about the walls that are being built in the area of Palestine. In 2003, the General Assembly of the United Nations adopts a resolution condemning the construction of a wall encroaching on the occupied Palestinian territory. In 2004, the International Court of Justice published an advisory opinion stating that the construction of the wall is contrary to international law. Sometimes this wall is called the Wall of Shame, or the apartheid war. And we know there are disagreements about how we could call this construction. So my question is this one. What is your analysis about this international wall built by Israel? Is it an international border in the making?
It's a great question. I don't think we should think of the West Bank wall that Israel has been building as an international border. However, a lot of analysts in the international system have speculated that the wall represents de facto the first steps of what would likely become the border were there to be a two-state solution. So if there is to be a two-state solution, probably that wall is going to become the border. And it's tempting to say that, but I think it's problematic for a number of reasons. Mm-hmm. The first reason is that we've already talked about some of the problems with thinking about the Green Line as a border itself, wall or not. There's this question of the populations on either side. There's this question of the region being conventionally, geographically, historically one country, which is hard to partition in any case. But also, that wall does not simply follow the Green Line. It juts deep into the West Bank. Like fingers or tendrils will reach deep into the West Bank. And it's not a wall singular. It's a wall plural with networks of walls. So in part, the West Bank wall that Israel began constructing that you made reference to divides Israel proper from the West Bank. But it also, within the West Bank, divides Israeli settlements from neighboring Palestinian communities, and also divides Palestinian communities from Palestinian communities, and completely encircles Jerusalem with a complex web or network of walls and checkpoints. So to de facto accept some contours of the wall as a border would mean to even reduce what would become the Palestinian state even smaller than the West Bank, which is already quite a small portion of the country. But also because of how much the wall, as I say, sort of is split up and runs through the country like a network rather than just a single linear line. But this wall was ruled illegal. The International Court of Justice found that the wall was illegal. It violated international law to the extent that it was not on the 67 Green Line. So they said to the extent that the wall was actually on within the West Bank on Palestinian territory, the court said it's illegal, it's got to be dismantled, and the Israeli government should pay reparations to the Palestinian communities impacted by it. But this is international law, and Israel has paid no attention to this ruling, along with the U.S., has completely dismissed this ruling. And technically speaking, the Court of Justice finding is non-binding. The way international law works, of course, to some extent, it's voluntary and non-binding, and the Israelis never recognized the authority of the court in this jurisdiction. So all the court could do is issue a finding that didn't actually it wasn't actually legally binding, so the Security Council couldn't take any further action from it. But it signals that in the court's view, the wall in various aspects is illegal. But it notably did not say that the wall between the West Bank and Israel is illegal. And the other interesting thing about this barrier is that it became this barrier that Israel began constructing in the early 2000s. It became the anvil or the hammer and the forge that built up the grassroots popular resistance movement among Palestinians in the West Bank between 2003 and 2005. And it lasted, this anti-wall protest movement really lasted about a decade. Maybe in pockets, it's still going today, but it's mostly been repressed and exhausted and overshadowed by other issues. But this anti-wall movement was the subject of my fieldwork and research that led to the book that I published on the topic. And it's this wall that was the main impetus for the international community to gradually come to recognize Israel as an apartheid state.
Mm-hmm.
It was the looking at this wall, the highly advanced developed Israeli communities on one side of the wall with their shopping malls and universities, and swimming pools, and on the other side of the wall, the stateless, dispossessed Palestinians in comparative standards living in slums. And with the checkpoints and martial law for the one population and Israeli citizenship and rights and freedoms for the other population, human rights groups from Amnesty International to Human Rights Watch, various organs of the United Nations, and also Israeli human rights groups have said, this is apartheid, and that has caused a lot of controversy recently. So the wall is a fascinating aspect for looking at the conflict, but also I think let's not jump to thinking about it as a border between two separate countries for all of the reasons I've tried to say.
Great. Thank you, Michael, for this answer. We know also that a part of this wall had been declared illegal by the Supreme Court of Israel itself and had to be modified around a village, the village of Bilin, in the interest of the Palestinian people. What do you think about this consideration of the local populations? This exception should be the norm, right?
Yes, this exception should be the norm. You're right that the Israeli Supreme Court looked at this particular case and said, the Israeli military has got to dismantle the wall and move it back, because the way it had been constructed, it had sort of de facto annexed most of the Palestinian village of Bilin's farmland. The wall had cut the village off from most of its farmland. And this is not unique to Bilin. This sort of thing where the wall was cutting off Palestinian communities from their lands and their pastures happens across the West Bank. But in this particular case, a couple of factors aligned to lead to the Israeli Supreme Court intervening on the side of the Palestinians. Now, the first factor is that the Palestinians in Bilin mobilized one of the loudest, most colorful social movements, protest movements against the wall, and really pioneered all sorts of new forms of protest, launching regular Friday protests, protesting against the wall, bringing international witnesses, international journalists, international activists to march mm-hmm. with them in very peaceful, often mostly nonviolent, though Palestinian youth would be throwing stones at Israeli forces, but a very colorful and loud demonstration with women and children and old and young taking place month after month, year after year. And the Israeli court eventually intervened for this reason, that the protests in Bilin had generated a lot of media attention in Israel and outside. So public pressure came with that. And there was this sort of political angle of, well, everybody's looking at Bilin and the clear annexation of their land. And so the courts intervened and ruled not on behalf of the Palestinians, because the Palestinians, directly at least, because the Palestinians were not allowed to make a claim under Israeli law because they're stateless, they're not citizens. But Israeli lawyers and organizations had raised the case on behalf of the Palestinians through the Israeli courts. And so when the court came down, they ruled in favor of the Israeli lawyers and organizations that had made the claim. And lo and behold, the military then dismantled, well, they dragged their feet for a few years, but finally they dismantled the wall and they moved it back something like a kilometer to actually the very outskirts of the nearest Israeli settlement there. And the people of Bilin regained access to their land. Now, so on the one hand, it was Palestinian popular protests that helped generate the pressure to make this change. But on the other hand, it was also a particularly egregious case of Israeli expansionism, because there was it involved a complex case of an Israeli development company violating Israeli domestic law in a kind of a case of fraud and corruption, where the settlement made the municipality of the settlement made claims to the Palestinian land that were fraudulent that were exposed in the Israeli courts. And so the Israeli courts deferred to the illegality of the expansion of this settlement and its ruling. Now, you're right, it should be the norm. Everywhere across the West Bank, the Israeli court should be intervening to roll the wall off Palestinian land. But many Palestinians have mixed feelings about this because the wall is still there. And many say in the bigger picture, whether it's here or it's there, it's illegitimate. And to celebrate that victory too much, though it was a victory for the local people, and it made a big difference in the lives of that village, there's also a sense of we don't want to legitimize the authority of the Israeli courts to have the right to make these decisions. And so it's a complex case, but I think it shows both the power of popular struggle and also shows the problem of thinking of the wall or the green line as itself inherently legitimate.
Thanks, Michael. We know the intense fragmentation of space, the controls of the roads, the problems that this causes for the freedom to come and go for the Palestinian and for their protection of the basic human rights. My last question is about your book, Palestinian Popular Struggle, published in 2019. And your book tells the stories of people who use unarmed and non-militarized popular modes of resistance in the face of coercive or contentious political actions. And you wrote this phrase, popular struggle is people power. In parallel of this example of the village of Bilin, do you have any other interesting examples to share with us?
Yeah, there's no shortage of fascinating cases of popular protest among Palestinians resisting the occupation and the separation barrier. And in my book, I go through a number of cases that are sort of part of the public record, a number of cases that I documented and bring to light on my own in my field research locally in small cases of weekly protests and other direct actions. A couple of interesting cases that come to mind would be in 2013. Now, this is not one that I witnessed, but many of my research participants, people I talked to and interviewed, really identified this case as a model for some of their thinking around direct action. And one of the things that they did was in a very contentious piece of land in the West Bank, just outside of Jerusalem, very important because it is so close to Jerusalem, and it's an area that had not been settled with an Israeli settlement. The Israeli government had often talked about settling it, but it was very contentious because many people regarded it as too close to Jerusalem and surrounded by too many Palestinian communities, and that if Israelis built settlements there, it would very much complete a ring of Israeli settlements that would effectively have cut the West Bank in half. And so there's this little plot of land outside of Jerusalem that has been contentious. Well, in 2013, the Israeli government boldly started to move to actually build a settlement there. Mm-hmm. And many of these Palestinian protesters, including people from the village of Bilin and people from many other villages and many other popular committees that were involved in this movement, organized a remarkable direct action where they, in the dead of night, moved several hundred protesters onto this plot of land to occupy it with their bodies and set up tents and invite international media and international witnesses and to occupy and say, this is our land, you're not going to build here. It's sort of a land defense direct action. And it actually drew a lot of international attention. I think because of its proximity to Jerusalem, because of the timing that it had happened, it was covered in all of the major press. Relatively small action, a few hundred people, but it was on the BBC, it was in the New York Times, and it seems to have generated enough international attention to it that the Israeli government backed down and they did not go on to develop that piece of land into the newest Israeli settlement. And to this day, it's in the news again because I think Israel has just announced they're actually going to finally try to build on it. But it has still to this day not been settled with an Israeli settlement, in part because of actions like this that have intervened when the Israeli government has started to talk about it. So this is an example of, I think, popular protest having the sort of power to influence major state politics. Another interesting example involves the Gaza Strip, and the Gaza Strip witnessed some major popular protests around 2018, 2019, when tens of thousands of people marched from their homes in Gaza City or other small villages and refugee camps in the Gaza Strip to the Israeli blockade, the barrier that has been constructed to trap the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. And they marched peacefully to the border, thousands of people. And it drew a lot of media attention again. And the response of the Israeli military was to use sniper fire to deter advances on the separation fence and barrier, and to shoot at protesters who were tampering with the barrier or who reached the barrier. And over the course of several weeks, hundreds of protesters were killed. I think over the period of the whole, what was called the Great March of Return, Palestinians marching to the Gaza border to protest the blockade and demand the right of return to their old homes inside Israel, going back to 1948. And this was a movement that really put Israeli occupation and blockade policies in a negative light in the press, and allowed for mainstream news outlets to shine a spotlight on Palestinian struggle, Palestinian suffering, and news outlets that you wouldn't expect talking about that were talking about it. And it was, even though it was disastrous for the protesters who were maimed for life or who were killed, I think it too was one of those things that contributed to a sea change that we see today, where it's becoming acceptable, or at least harder to deny, that these policies are apartheid-like policies. So those are two examples of where popular protest meets border dispute, I think.
Thank you for sharing with us these two important examples. Popular struggle is people power, of course, but popular books and popular ideas are also people power. My last question, Michael, what are your reading tips for prospective students interested in border studies and the Middle East?
Well, thank you. Yes. So in terms of popular politics as a concept, as a theory, a lot of this overlaps with or includes some of the research literature on civil resistance, on strategic nonviolence. So a great source to go to is a classic work called Why Civil Resistance Works. And it's by Erica Chenoweth and Mariah Stephan. Chenoweth and Stephan have a great empirical study of sort of the power of unarmed methods to challenge not only domestic law, but foreign occupation and authoritarian governance. So it's a great staple in the research literature today, demonstrating how unarmed people power can make a real difference. I would also direct people to Robin Kelicotti's, who has been helping to extend the boundaries of what we mean by civil disobedience, to be able to apply civil disobedience to cases that have not always been thought of as civil disobedience. And this can include cross-border forms of protest, and also forms of protest that include minimal levels of violence or minor levels of violence. James Tully is a great thinker in this area for his work on global citizenship and acts of crossing, acts that pursue freedom through dissent and disobedience that happen to cross borders. Also, the work of Alexander Livingston, the work of Maurice Sterrell. These are some great sources to get into the idea of what popular politics or popular struggle is all about. On the Middle East more broadly, some standard sources are Rashid Khalidi, Ramzi Baroud, you could even still go back to Edward Said. He's still a timeless source of knowledge on the construction and understanding and the politics of the Middle East. Ilan Pappé is another great source on Middle Eastern issues. On popular politics in the Middle East, specifically, you can see a book by Mazen Kamsia. You can see a great book by John Chalcraft. There's some new work coming out by scholars like Emma Swan on how popular politics is and nonviolent protest is being conceived in the Middle East today. That might be a good start.
Yes, I think so. Thank you very much, Michael Carpenter, for participating in our podcast series. It was a great discussion and a great overview about a very complex region of the world.
Thank you, Ben. This was my first podcast, so thank you for letting me be part of this experience, especially among all the ranks of the great names that you've been speaking to over the past weeks and months. So it's been a pleasure and an honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. This was the Borders in Globalization podcast. Today, we were with Michael Carpenter, political scientist, researcher, and editor at the University of Victoria in Canada. We talked about the Middle East, borders, and popular protest movements. Thank you for your attention and see you soon for the next issue. Bye-bye.